I'm Jordan Paris, and this is Trending Up.
And we are live. My guest today, I've got with me George Arison. George is an immigrant from Eurasia. He came over here, started some companies, and he's crushing it. And we're going to talk about his journey today. So, George, actually, I read your the article in the New York Times about how about your family and how you met your partner. And I thought it was really touching. I'm like, you know, because I've been in pizzerias in New York. And like, so I'm just like imagining in my head, you know, like it was very eloquent the way. So the men met by chance at Molteria, a deaf owned and operated pizzeria, and soon migrated from adjacent tables to start a conversation that flowed easily for hours. So like, what was I gotta know, as a student of human behavior, like what was the cue to like, oh, it's okay to talk to each other, like we can migrate tables now?
Well, I think gay men our age are generally pretty good about kind of grasping that, right? Because we're still of the generation when it was like, when we were in our, you know, teens and early 20s, it was not really okay to be gay. So mm-hmm. You have to have much better gay radar versus now, when like I think it's a lot easier. But I think we just kind of liked each other and started talking. So it became a great conversation, and we haven't stopped talking since, which is kind of good. And the most amazing thing about our relationship is that we're very, very different people in like every way imaginable. You know, Robert is very introverted, and I'm very extroverted.
He's a doctor, right? Yeah. Oh, a scientist.
Yeah, he's a scientist. Like, he's a doctor, and I'm like very, you know, on the business side of things. Like, so I say things that he totally doesn't understand what I'm talking about, and he'll say things that I totally don't understand what he's talking about. But we both really value a few things that are really important to us. Families, obviously, one of them. Like, we really care about family, kids, and just having, you know, the support network of people around us and taking care of people. And we are both like really, I think, into achievement and academic success, and are not apologetic about it, if that makes any sense. And so that also makes it a lot easier for us to get along. And in some ways, I feel like it's actually great that we are not alike, like we're not in the same industry or the same space, because that way we don't have to talk about those things together and be competitive about that, versus like, hey, we can complement each other in that way. So,
I feel you. I think that, you know, that's important. Not that I would, you know, be able to speak from experience. I mean, I'm very, very single, but like, I don't think that I'd want to, you know, be with someone in like the same space that I'm in. So let me think. Like, okay, so you come over from Eurasia in like when? Like, this is
I moved to the US when I was 14 in 1992.
Okay.
So this is like, I got into prep school, Soviet Union still existed. I got approved to leave when the Soviet Union was still around. And then before I was kind of able to leave, because I had to come in, you know, the next year for the academic year, Soviet Union fell apart. And so I kind of escaped right on the kind of back end of that. It was totally crazy, right? Because the country I was from didn't actually exist anymore, technically. And the new country I was from wasn't yet either in existence, but like, you clearly are from somewhere, right? And like, you know, there's one flight out of Georgia to leave anywhere, and you go to Moscow, and then from Moscow you fly to New York. Mm-hmm. Totally nutty how it all worked out. And I mean, much more crazy stuff has happened since then, obviously, including what we're living through right now. But for me, that was a pretty remarkable thing to be able to come to this, and I was very lucky.
So was Taxi Magic is that your first company that you started?
Yeah.
So, which, by the way, now for people, I'm actually going to share my screen. It's called now Go Curb. You can see that, George, right?
Yep, exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
So this is your first company. And
yeah, I was still pretty young, didn't really know anything about business. But I had a really awesome mentor named Tom DePasquale, who is a very experienced entrepreneur. And with him and a couple other people, plus my co-CEO at Shift, Toby Russell, we all started what is now Curb, initially known as Taxi Magic. And our concept really focused on two things. One is, can you use a mobile device? At that point, it was a BlackBerry, was the primary device people used for business, to book a taxi to come to you. And number two, can you use a BlackBerry to pay for taxi once you're done with that service?
A BlackBerry.
So this is still like, you know, way pre-Uber, pre-Lyft. iPhone doesn't yet exist. And the primary device for business travelers is a BlackBerry. So that's kind of why we focus on that. Of course, what you discover while you do that is that people are, the BlackBerry was not really good at allowing third-party software to be downloaded onto it. I mean, the concept of an app didn't really even exist yet. Like, that was totally new and foreign. And an app store certainly did not exist. And so you had to go through a really kludgy process to enable the download of a third-party app. And that really definitely got in the way of what we initially intended to do from the business travel perspective. Then the iPhone came out. We were a very early app on the iPhone. You know, the day we launched, I think we had something like 30,000 downloads because it was such a unique kind of product at that point.
How is that even possible? How do you get 30,000 downloads? How do you, like, is that a case where, like, build it and they will come? Like yeah, 10 years ago? I mean, now it's certainly not the case. Build it and they won't come. But
no,
maybe
but back
then
it
was.
This is like year one of the iPhone, right? The App Store was just opening up. There's not that many apps in it. Uh-huh. And there's not that much you can do with the phone itself. And so we were just really, really lucky. And the word just spread through word of mouth. Now, some of this was like we had text messages. We were able to send text messages to people once we had an app. So in our product iteration, like we had a BlackBerry app, we had a Windows mobile app. Then we actually created a text messaging product where you could book a taxi through text message. Mm-hmm. And so we had a lot of phone numbers for people. And so we were able to use those as a way to market our way to, you know, telling people that this existed. But in San Francisco in particular, the thing took off like crazy because here, like everybody had an iPhone and booking a taxi in San Francisco was really tough back in the day. There was a very big limit on the number of taxi cabs that were allowed to be on the street. I think the limit was like 1,200 cars, which is like nowhere near enough. And so cabs were always in massive demand and it was really tough to find them. And so as soon as people started to learn about the fact that you could do this, it really took off like crazy. And so we were super lucky. Apple then put us into some of their ads. And so like I have like you know a copy of the New York Times with four different applications profiled by Apple, and one of them is Taxi Magic. You know, I think we built a really awesome product. We did make a ton of mistakes along the way around kind of monetization and freemium product.
Tell me.
Too early for that. So internally at our company, especially because of the board, like we had a lot of people from the taxi industry involved, nobody wanted to give a product to the driver. Right? Everyone's like, why would you give a product to the driver? Just go through the cab company as your partner. But the problem is that the cab company didn't want to prioritize you as a service. And so that created a really bad user experience. That was one really big problem. And then secondly, you know, our board really was a big believer in SaaS, that you have to charge for the product if it's being used, because if you don't charge now, you'll never charge. Obviously, like we know today that that's not how products succeed. You actually give it away for free first and then start charging. And, you know, we wanted to do that, but we just couldn't get our board to agree. And so we always would charge a customer for using our service. And that was a mistake because what we should have done is given it away for free. Like obviously people would pay for the cab service, but nothing else, and really grown the user base a lot more and frequency of transaction a lot more. That would have given you a lot more leverage vis-a-vis the cab companies and made sure that they did what you wanted them to do. And that would have created a very different kind of outcome. Like, I don't think Uber and Lyft would have happened the way they did had we done that and had the auto industry, sorry, had the taxi industry moved along with us to change. So if you look at Asia, like there, you know, you have Grab Taxi as a product and you have Didi. Both of them still have a ton of cab companies on as service providers. And it's because the cab companies in Asia learned from the Uber or Lyft experience in the US that, hey, we better not like stand in the way of this. We better try to cooperate with this in some way.
So what were you you weren't charging on like the download of the app, right?
No, we were charging per transaction. So we had a like $1.99 charge per transaction.
To
use the product. And then we had a charge to the cab company of like 50 or 90 cents to get an order from us. And I think both of those should have been free in the beginning. Like for the first, you know, I don't know, 10 million rides, who the hell cared whether we charged or not, right? We should have given that away for free and grown the user base a lot more and kind of use that as a way to market rather than try to make money.
So with this company, you know, obviously it's not as well known as like Uber or Lyft.
Totally.
And you know, perhaps like this is one of the reasons why, even though like it, you came out with this like 2 years before Uber, right?
That's right. Yeah.
So you ran into some of these mistakes, but what ended up happening? Like, did you make an exit?
So I ended up having to leave in 2010 because my green card was rejected through employee sponsorships, and I had to go somewhere else to get my green card. And so ended up kind of moving on and whatnot. And I went to Google because I wanted to move to the West Coast because I knew that I wanted to do another company, and it made more sense to do a company on the West Coast rather than the East Coast. But Taxi Magic itself, so I was able to sell my ownership in Taxi Magic about 2 years after I left, which was great because it really changed, you know, my financial profile dramatically. Like I went from never having any money to actually having savings, and it was really awesome. Right. And I think it gave me a lot of an impetus to like do my next company quickly because I didn't have that. I had a little bit more of a financial flexibility in what I would do. And then Taxi Magic itself sold to Verifone and then sold to a different conglomerate after that. We ended up at Taxi Magic after I left, they also got into processing credit cards for cab companies, like when you swipe in the back of the car for car payment. And so that product was, quite valuable to credit card process. And so that's what's being very heavily used now. You know, in the time when I left Taxi Magic in 2010 and by 2012, really, Uber and Lyft really took off, right? Mm-hmm. The history there is that Uber did a black car product first. And so basically their black car product was the equivalent of what Taxi Magic's product was for cabs. And then Lyft came in with this idea that like any driver should be able to, you know, drive a car and provide a service. And they were really the true innovators in the space, if you think about it, in terms of like fundamental business model change. And then Uber, because it had so much infrastructure around the country, copied Lyft's model and started doing the same thing in a lot more locations than Lyft. And that's when, the cab companies were left behind and this, the new industry really took off.
Yeah. So, you know, you moved on though into your next company, which is Shift, and you've raised like, and we'll talk about what that company is and how you've grown that, but you've raised like $113 million in funding for that company. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but
we raised more than that, actually close to like 225, right. 230 in equity and have a $7 million debt. So we raised a lot of money, but fundraising is not the be all and end all, right? Fundraising is the beginning. It's not the end. We live in a world where, unfortunately, I think too many people think, oh, I raised money, so I succeeded. It's actually, I think, the opposite. You raise money, and now you have to actually deliver. So
yeah, now you have to do something with that money. Yeah. Okay, but like, so, how does one, like the average person, like, I mean, we're all at one point or another, we were all like average people. I mean, like, how did you figure out, like, how does one figure out how to like go to the next level in terms of like starting companies and raising such insane amounts of capital? Like, this is different from like, this is not like a rinky dink company. Like, this is like a real, like, how do you figure out how to do that? You immigrate here. How do you figure out how to do that and raise so much capital? It's ridiculous.
I knew nothing about fundraising. So at Taxi Magic, somebody else did fundraising, and we had this super experienced entrepreneur, Tom, who was our co-founder. And so he kind of handled all that. I had like some insight into what happens, but not really in a lot of detail. When I moved to the Valley in 2010, one of the things I spent a lot of time on is just meeting a lot more investors and VCs, just to kind of learn, right? Not so much, hey, I want to do this company, more like teach me how all this works. And I had a really good buddy who was my co-founder at Shift named Joel Washington, who had spent a few years working at a venture capital firm. So that was also really valuable because he kind of knew how the venture capital world works. And so when we were getting the business started initially, I'm kind of paying for a lot of the initial testing of the product in 2003. Toby and I had this agreement that if we didn't do the company and lost money, you know, we'd split the losses. But we're paying for the stuff ourselves. And we think, but at some point we're going to have to raise money. And so we're like, how do we do that? And Joel's like, well, we should do a convertible note. And this is like 2013. I have no idea what a convertible note even stands for. And I'm like, what's a convertible note? So then I go and learn about convertible notes. And we, then build a PowerPoint and start talking to people we knew. And one of the core theses for us was, hey, to get started, let's get everybody in, from every job we ever had as founders, let's go try to get somebody to invest from one of those jobs. And so we went out to people we knew and said, hey, will you invest? Then we, went to broader people we knew who would be a value add, right? Like product leaders, business leaders, CEOs, and raise money from them. And, it's basically just a risk that people take on you and the team, because at this point, there's nothing, right? And so we raised the first $900,000 kind of that way through just the network we had, et cetera. And then we had one institutional group called AmTrust, which is a insurance company. They invested as well, which was really awesome. They were at that point our largest shareholder. And then that early money, that first like roughly $1 million, is almost like yeast, right? That's what they're saying, like early money is like yeast, which is where Emily's List comes from. I think that same thing is very true for business in terms of getting started. Once you have some cash raised, it's a lot easier to raise the next set of cash. Because a lot of investors who might be unwilling to take the risk when you're like on your own or just very early will come in later on. So, I really obviously value tremendously what the very first people did for us, because we were so early and we didn't really have even a proof of concept yet. So we kind of build on that and end up doing what back then was a very large seed round of about $3.8 million. Today, it's like a tiny round, but in 2013, 2014, it was actually quite large. And then we were lucky because, 2014, 15, 16, 17, 18, really even, were like the best times to raise capital because markets were just available, to you in every way. And so we raised in pretty good times for our Series A and our Series B, and they're really lucky. Then, there was some wobbling in the market back in 2016, 2017, and so we actually had a much harder time raising the C. Some of it had to do with our own issues, like our performance after the Series B was not where it needed to be. And so raising the next round was a much more challenging enterprise. And then, things improved for us and we're in a really good place and got a really awesome deal. I think, for me, fundraising is what I call a process of discovery, meaning talking to more people makes a ton of sense. Because you need to be in the effort of like, hey, let's find who are the right investors for me, who have the thesis around investments that matches my company, and then see if they would invest, rather than, hey, I'm going to just reach out to a few investors and try to convince them that my company should be funded. Because a lot of people might really like your company, but they won't do your deal because it doesn't fall into the category of deals that they do. And then a lot of people who are in the category might actually really like the category, but might know your deal for whatever reason. And so talking to more people, I don't think is a bad idea. I think it actually makes a lot of sense. And then secondly, I think it's really crucial for early fundraising is the team, right? Having a really awesome team and really great people around you is really critical.
Definitely.
I think this idea of like a founder can do it himself is totally a fallacy. It's really hard to do. And so teams really matter a ton. So now you're looking at Shiv.com. People are welcome to go to Shiv.com and then buy a car if they'd like. We come to you with a test drive to your house. That's always been our product. So it's kind of with the unique innovation that we have in our business model is the test drive delivered to the customer. But in this world of COVID, obviously that's particularly popular.
I think it's really, you've probably seen an uptick in business. Yeah, maybe.
It's been, we've definitely been hit by COVID, especially in the early days, because, California was the kind of first state to shut down and by far most restrictive, right? And this is where core of our business is in California. And so we definitely suffered from that quite a bit. And then, we expected a pretty substantial fall in demand because, my assumption was that people would not be buying cars in this environment. So initially we definitely suffered a ton and we actually had to follow a lot of people because we didn't know where demand would be. And so we were really worried about that. But then demand picked up and we're not yet quite where we would want to be in May, right? Like May is a big growth month for our industry and we should be doing a lot better than we are, but we are definitely better than we were in March and better than we were in April. We are basically now equaling our February sales on a week-to-week basis, which is great, right? Like to be back to where you were 2 months ago in light of what's happened is really fantastic. We've been able to bring a lot of our furloughed folks back to work, nice. Which has been awesome as well, because furloughing in this environment was just really painful and horrible for me. So that's been fantastic. And I think we are seeing an uptick in overall car demand, because I think people want to buy cars now instead of using public transportation, because they're very nervous about, you know, being in public transportation environments. And then in my sense is that used cars will be more in demand now than new, given the economic environment. We really do very well with older used vehicles, so like cars that are 6, 7, 8 or more years in age. We have a lot of those for sale, and so we're seeing a lot of demand for those types of cars. Mm. It's been like usually those are about 25% of our sales, but in April they were averaging like 35 to 40% of our sales.
Well, I've got a demand for this type of car, the luxury car. I like the luxury.
We have a lot of those too.
Now, but like, again, how did you get your first, say, I don't know, however many users, how'd you get like 100 people to like sign up to use this service?
Yeah. So
zero to 100.
One of the things I really liked about doing Shift and the idea of Shift was that, you had existing listing sites like Cars.com, AutoTrader,
right.
CarGurus.
Been on Cars.com for a long time. Yeah. I like using that.
That you could use to generate demand. And so part of the problem with marketplace businesses is that it's a chicken and the egg thing. Like, do you go after supply first? Do you go after demand first? Which one do you do? And it's risky to try to do that, right? In the auto thing, what I liked is that, you know, even though driving demand from, say, CarGurus.com isn't the ideal thing, because those customers are very price sensitive and they want to buy like at the bottom of the pricing ladder. You can still get those customers for a very inexpensive CAC. And so in the beginning, what we really focused on was supply acquisition, like getting cars into our inventory, and then getting demand into the buyers from these third-party listing sites. And really, we kind of jerry-rigged Craigslist. We put a team together in the country of Georgia, where I'm originally from. And that team would contact people on Craigslist and ask them if they were willing to sell the car to them. So like there's, you know, millions of people list cars.
That's
on
savvy.
Craigslist. And so you'd be reaching out to them on that. And so, you know, cost effective because it's in Georgia and it's good inventory. So that's kind of how we started. Then we discovered that, you know, doing very targeted marketing on Facebook and Google for sellers made a lot of sense as well, because actually a lot of people are searching for, hey, how do I sell my car? And options are limited. And so that was another really great way to get customers. And then as we grew, word of mouth took off, right? And so we have to go through this process of like, how do we start a market every time we open a new market? So we kind of do it all the time. But in San Francisco or in LA, where we've been around now for, you know, 5 years, and our market share is very high in San Francisco, for example. Now a lot of it is word of mouth. Like, people know about us and come to us because they know about us. We've never until April done any kind of like brand marketing, which is kind of remarkable when you think about how much we've grown and without having done that. Then when COVID hit, we discovered that pricing for TV marketing has gone down dramatically.
Oh, yeah.
You're now paying for TV about a third of what you would have paid pre-COVID. And so we're like, hey, it's actually an amazing time to start getting on the air and doing marketing, because this is the time to build brand.
Nice.
And so we've been on TV now for the first time actually building brand, and we'll do a lot more of that. Nice. You know, in some respects, recessions are obviously terrible, right? And like, so many people are out of work, so many people don't have an income, et cetera.
But great opportunity.
But this opportunity from the perspective of building a business is actually a really good opportunity, because costs are down. And so things that would cost a lot more money before cost less money now. And you have leverage. And so for businesses like ours that are more recession-proof, like demand for used cars is always going to be there, recession or no recession, it's a really good opportunity. And I think, you know, from our shareholders' perspective and our employees' perspective, it makes a lot of sense to try to take advantage of that. You know, we're seeing right now, for example, one of our analog companies, Vroom, right, is going public. They just released their S-1 yesterday. And it's going to be one of, like, very few IPOs. And certainly one of the very, very few commerce, like e-commerce related IPOs. But it's because it's a really good business in a recession, and they're sensing this opportunity to take advantage of the market, by the way, huge congratulations to that team. I have an amazing CEO, and so I'm really happy that they're making that step. They're a little bit older in terms of age and yeah. bigger than us. But I think it kind of points to the fact that there's demand here, and we're really excited about that.
Mm, nice. Last thing, turning an idea into a multi-million dollar company, it seems the common theme has been, with Curb and now Shift, cars. Why cars? How did you come up with these ideas?
The crazy thing is that I don't actually even like to drive. I think I've driven maybe once or twice this year to go to a coffee shop. Nice. So I almost never drive. The taxi magic thing made sense from that perspective because I had such a need for on-demand transportation.
Yes.
Doing a car sales company doesn't make sense at all.
But taxi magic, was that a problem in your life? This would be a lot more convenient. Okay. And then you huge created problem. A business around it. Yeah.
Yeah. A huge problem because I would constantly try to get taxis when I was a BCG consultant. It was a huge pain in one place and I hated it. On the Shift side, that was also a problem for me personally in that I had a leased car that I needed to buy out. I tried to get financing from different banks for it and they would not do it. They're go to a dealer to get financing. And I'm like, I already have the car in my possession. Why am I going to a dealer? It makes no sense. And that's sort of how I got interested in this idea. And then Toby knew a lot more about the auto industry and kind of pushed me to really investigate because he thought there was a huge opportunity there. So that's kind of how this got started. At least so far, I've really liked ideas that I can relate to, and that both of these I can relate to.
Yeah, sure.
And I like consumer businesses, right? Now, I think having been an entrepreneur in the consumer space now in aggregate total 10 years, you learn that actually consumer is really tough. And there's a lot of appeal to doing enterprise and SaaS as a result. Not that that's not hard, but there's just a different issue there and there's much more limited kind of user-based question. The flip side is SaaS businesses, enterprise businesses, can reach a certain scale and then kind of plateau because there are only so many massive enterprise businesses, right, that are public and are worth, many billions of dollars. That's much more possible on the consumer side in terms of building something huge. And so, we've been kind of approaching it from, I've always liked the consumer thing, but that might change in the future. Shift's not the last company I'm going to start, and
I imagine it's not going to be.
There's going to be many more to come. I joke sometimes. So I have a son now, right? My son is 8 months old, and
it's exciting.
And I also have a daughter. She's also 8 months old.
Twins.
They're like twins. They're called twiblings.
Yeah,
they have two different surrogates, but they were born 9 days apart.
I've never heard of that before. I'm gonna go down the rabbit hole on Google later. I gotta look, what is it called? Twiblings?
Yeah, twiblings, and siblings together.
That's really interesting.
Anyway, so we have these two amazing children who are just completely and really incredible. And so the joke at home is, Amelia is gonna be president and Luca's gonna have a spaceship company. My last company I'll help start will be related to spaceships. But I like doing businesses and I'll continue doing that for a long time.
Nice. Well, I look forward to seeing you turn more ideas into multi-million dollar companies. And I'm looking forward to the spaceship company too. That'll be fun.
In about reminds me 30 of years.
Moon Express. You ever hear of Moon Express with Naveen Jain?
No, I have not. Is that a movie?
So Naveen, he started a lot of companies like Viome and stuff like that. The gut health company, so his other company Moon Express is he's the first private company to have permission to leave Earth's orbit or atmosphere, not orbit, but the atmosphere. And Moon Express is a cool company.
I think there is a ton of, I find space mining, mining asteroids, et cetera, just an incredible concept. And so definitely we'll have something, to do there one day. Still probably a little
moon
early
rocks
for me, but eventually. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Naveen is obsessed with moon rocks. That's what we talked about when I interviewed him last year. But George, this has been fun. Thanks for teaching us today. And so let me think. Shift.com. People can, that's your current company there. Also George Arison on LinkedIn. If you're watching on LinkedIn, his profile is linked in the description of this live. And is there anywhere else, George?
Anything else? I mean, Twitter too. You can go to George Arison on Twitter, but I'm not, I'm very early days of Twitter, let's say, in my life. I'm not been tweeting that much.
Yeah, me too. I'm not as well versed in Twitter as the other platforms. But George, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Great to talk to you. Bye.